Welcome to Education Suspended, a podcast focused on exploring, engaging, and dialoguing with those in education who are passionate about changing the status quo and evolving the archaic system we have inherited. Hey everyone, welcome to Education Suspended. Jessica Pfeiffer here. It's very weird for me because I'm actually recording this introduction super early. Because when this goes live, I'm going to be on an airplane headed to Europe with my family. I've got my first international presentations. I'm going to be presenting in Prague at an educational conference and then presenting in Oslo to an educational organization. So super excited about that. It's crazy that the school year is almost over. There were moments I thought it was going so slow, and yet now that I'm saying it out loud, I feel like it went really fast, which I think probably happens every single school year. All right, so let's jump into today's episode. We finally got an occupational therapist to sit down with us, and we did our best to take full advantage of it. So we connected with Tracy De Maria. She's an occupational therapist out on the East Coast. And right from the beginning, she really helps lay the groundwork for us to better understand sensory integration, regulation, these words that we use pretty commonly, not just on this podcast, but more in education these days. She also talks about what are some practical activities that we can actually build into our day with kids. She's got a really cool background and shares with us how she ties it all together. And again, the theme of Education Suspended is this theme of rhythm and why it is so important. And she does a really good job of giving us the neuro perspective of rhythm. So we were really grateful for that. I really hope you enjoy this episode. It was such a great time meeting her and connecting with her, and she's doing a lot of great work out there. So sit back and enjoy Education Suspended with Tracy De Maria.
Well, I just got in off the road.
Oh, geez.
Is it De Maria? De Maria or De Maria? I don't know. We'll ask her.
I was the keynote presenter at the National School Social Work Conference, and literally, I was walking out and she says, oh my gosh, that was amazing. I'm an OT. I go, oh, you should be on our podcast. I go, you should email me. Okay, bye. And we walked by.
Oh, really?
And that's it. And then she did. She followed up like a week later, which is awesome.
I know. I'm very excited to talk to her.
We've been wanting an OT on here for a while. Okay, here she is.
Let her in.
Hello.
Hi, Tracy. Welcome to Education Suspended.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited. Steve was asking, he's like, how do you know each other? I'm like, we don't.
Literally met passing. I got to hear the wonderful Jessica speak and I was like, hey, you. And she said, hey, you. And that's how we're here.
And that's how right. We're here.
So is it De Maria or De Maria?
Thank you for guessing. It is De Maria.
I mean, I think to say we're excited to have an OT join us is probably an understatement. We have been trying to tackle an OT who's silly enough to hop on this podcast for a long time. So thank you for doing this. I say for the last several years, I tell a lot of people in my next lifetime, I'm going to become an occupational therapist because I love the work that you do. So we have a lot of questions. Let us know if we bombard you. But just so you know, Tracy, we start all of our episodes the same. So I'm going to have you say hello to our listeners, talk about what you do, how you got there. And then if you would share anything that you feel pertinent about your own story as a student and any connections that may have to now, that'd be great. So we'll just start with that.
Sounds good. So I had a unique education experience. When I was younger, I went to boarding school for high school, and that was a very interesting thing for me. I had undiagnosed learning disabilities, and then once I got into boarding school, I started to realize that I needed to care about education, because prior to that, I didn't, but they were very helpful in explaining that if I got good grades, I would have my nights free. So that was my first kind of motivation to kick in and try to become a student. And then actually got my first IEP in high school. I would say that was the start of my interest in special education, and definitely was my interest in the advocacy part of me that enjoys just kind of going out there and making sure everybody gets what they need to be properly educated in schools. My sister also had dyslexia. And my mother was an educator. So she kind of taught me always, well, you know, Albert Einstein had learning disabilities. And so I kind of came from a place of empowerment. And once I had my learning disability diagnosis, I was like, aha, I understand. And then I had always wanted to be a child psychiatrist. That was my initial drive and desire. And I have a mathematics learning disability. So the practicality of that wasn't so great. So I did some time shadowing occupational therapy, actually in a state psychiatric hospital. And so I was like, aha, this is amazing. I can do psychiatry, but I want to work with kids. So then I went out to Colorado. I went to college there and I got my bachelor's, but had some unique experience with prejudice and discrimination, where my fellow OT students actually tried to fight the school against us having our accommodations and said we were getting unfair advantages. So that was unique. And then I was just so fortunate as to get an internship with the wonderful Lois Hickman, and she had a sensory farm clinic. And so I started doing OT on the farm with music and animals and really learning about regulation and drumming. And for a Jersey girl originally, it was a whole new way of looking at the world. So when I moved back home to New Jersey, I opened a private practice. And that's when I really started to get a feeling for the fact that sensory integration and mental health with OTs kind of did go together well. My son was born in 2005. He has autism. And so I ended up closing my practice when I realized working after school hours and weekends was not going to fly. So I landed in public schools and I've been working there since then. I went back and got my master's in OT and then continuing on to get a clinical doctorate in OT. So I'm from start to finish an OT through and through.
Tracy, I want to confess something right away.
What?
I was not a stupid teacher, but an ignorant one when it comes to OT. And I just went by the OT room in my school and saw they had really great adaptive equipment. And that's what I thought they did. I had no idea until I started to work with Jessica and others around brain development and connecting it to, you know, neuroscience, really what an OT does. So would you mind giving us the elementary version, what OTs are special at? Because I was one of those people ignorant of what you do.
Well, that is my favorite question to answer. And I understand that there is not a lot of information about our occupation. As professionals, OTs are very passionate about what we do. And we know we're not the best at getting our message and our research out there because we're so, I'd like to think of it as us being so busy in the trenches. But yes, occupational therapy started as a mental health profession after World War II. We were working more with people who had, you know, returning home from World War II and needing that purposeful and that meaningful thing that they would do, that through that activity, that thing that they did, they would in and of itself have therapeutic benefits. So that's what I would say in terms of OT and where it comes from and where we still always go back to. It's about our occupations, which is why OTs are sticking their nose in everything. Because we really learn that if it's important to the person, it is someplace that we belong. If you cannot participate in an occupation, which is anything you do in life, that is meaningful to you or necessary, then we can step in and help you find a way to achieve those goals, to figure out, you know, we learn about task analysis, what's involved in the task from a more physical or emotional and cognitive perspective. So we're trained in neuroanatomy, in psychology, as well as physical anatomy. We're pretty well-rounded in that perspective. And I would say in the schools a lot, I have to really educate people a lot about my mental health background and that we do use cognitive behavioral frame of reference, and we have a lot of these skills also in our wheelhouse, but we also can hop over and jump to the sensory integration theory and also go to an adaptive theory. So I also love getting into my theory, but I'll leave it there.
Grainer, great question. I had a very similar one, but I'm wondering, Tracy, if you can then also talk a little bit about what, if any, might the differences be that a family experiences receiving occupational therapy through a private entity outside of education versus through an IEP?
That's an excellent question. So It varies from state to state. And how, you know, I live in Pennsylvania. I work in New Jersey. I've done educational advocacy in both states, and even just right across the line, it is very different. It also depends on the specific district. You know, right across the bridge in Pennsylvania where I live, it was just almost not even considered that if you had difficulties with handwriting, your child would get OT through an IEP. So my son, when he was classified and received his IEP, they were like, oh yeah, no, we're not even going to consider it. So I had to seek out private OT for him. Whereas in my school district that I'm in now in New Jersey, we do that a lot. And we look at it as that, well, written communication is a necessary function for your academics. If you ask me, in some schools, it's too much with the handwriting and too much with the focus on that. And people really did start to look at OTs as fine motor and handwriting specialists and handwriting teachers. And as a person with severe dysgraphia, that was always comical to me. I did take my training and I know how to teach it, but I definitely go by the, okay, it's legible, we're good. And especially with computers and speech to text, and there's so much we can do, but that's really the difference, is that it depends on the district and district policies. And to put on my educational advocate hat for a second, you know, if you're not comfortable with your school's policy, you can always ask them to show it to you in writing, what their policy is, and make sure that the district's policy aligns with the state policy as well as the federal code.
I'm glad that you brought up the handwriting piece, because similar to Steve, so Steve's been an educator for years, I have been a social worker. And even when I moved and pivoted to become a school social worker, I also took for granted and had limited understanding about occupational therapy within the educational setting. And to your point, one of the things that I always did hear was like, oh, it's handwriting, it's handwriting, it's handwriting. And it wasn't until I started diving into the neuroscience world with Grainer that the veil was lifted of like, oh my God, it's so much more. And you keep saying this word, it's sensory integration, it's regulation.
Absolutely.
So I know we're kind of bouncing all over, but can we break those two words apart, and then we can go probably to broader questions, but I just want to make sure the vocabulary is the set. So can we talk a little bit about sensory integration and regulation?
Yeah. So sensory integration, it has a lot of different meanings in terms of how you're going to hear OTs throw it around, or neuroscientists, or parents, or clinicians, in that sensory integration is something we all do. We take the sensory information from our environment and we integrate it for an adaptive response. That's hopeful. That would be adaptive sensory integration process. Sensory integration is also a theory. At the time it was developed, was to work primarily with children ages 5 to 12, roughly, with learning disabilities. When I got my sensory integration training, what I was being specifically trained in is something called the sensory integration and praxis test. It is a test that is rarely, if ever, used anymore. It takes at least 2 hours to administer. And you're looking at praxis. So there's this piece of sensory integration that is kind of not really understood, which is motor planning, your ability to conceptualize, plan, and carry out any motor sequence. So that is a big component of it. And this sensory integration and praxis test looks at sensory discrimination abilities. Are you registering that sensory information correctly? Can you feel it if someone is drawing a letter on the back of your hand? That's literally one of the subtests. So what are you feeling and what are you registering in your sensory systems? So it looks a lot at that discrimination ability, which has little to do with regulation as we know it. They're related, and they can be connected in that it's common for someone with a difficulty with sensory discrimination to also have sensory regulation difficulties, but they are not in and of themselves the same thing. So it is very complicated science that takes a long time to learn and articulate, but I would say that sensory integration is a theory, it is something we do, and it is a type of treatment that's administered typically by OTs.
I'm going to follow that question with something I've observed in a lot of the kids that Jessica and I have had the privilege to work with. And we talk about sensory integration, it probably through a neuroscience lens more than anything else. So correct me if this question doesn't make any sense. But I have noticed in reviewing cases of children is that often their disrupted attachment also results in a sensory integration challenge. I don't even want to say more than that. I just would like you to comment on that connection and why we often see that connection and why we teachers often miss that connection. And then it comes out in behavior that we don't understand.
So that's a wonderful question. I mean, I actually am going to have to more apologize to any OTs, whoever might hear this and go, oh, she messed up her explanation of sensory integration, because a lot of what I do more now in my daily practice is look at it all as nervous system. You know, the nervous system's dysregulated and you can see sensory related deficits because of that. And whether it's from impaired attachment and trauma, adverse experiences, or whether it's from, you know, exposure in utero to drugs and alcohol or genetic disorders or learning difficulties. I mean, I really look at it as the brain gets in these dysfunctional states for a myriad of reasons. And I do see attachment affecting it. So if you're not feeling safe, your nervous system, your brain is going to be on a higher alert. You know, you're going to be more in that fight or flight at all times. And so you're not going to be able to regulate as easy. So you're going to see more likely some of these sensory disturbances. A lot of the kids that I worked with early on in my private practice, you know, I would see a lot of children that were adopted and had lack of exposure to sensory input. And that can also be connected with attachment at times. So if there's not proper bonding and not proper touch, and they're not getting those, they're not getting the exposure to the sensory information. So it depends on the root cause of the attachment problems, I would say, not to deflect that question back. But if you're not able to develop attachment with a child because the parent has a mental illness, how else is that affecting the relationship? You know, is there less touch? Is there less emotional availability? Is there less co-regulation going on in teaching? Is there more modeling of dysregulated behavior? Does that answer your question?
I didn't have a preconceived answer, I guarantee you, to that question. But I think we often see that sort of the rhythm in which kids receive outside stimulus through our senses, that rhythm seems disrupted. Often these are the children we find out that, you know, throw desks and flip tables and trash bulletin boards because the overwhelming sensory input drives them crazy. I didn't understand that as a teacher. You know,
yeah, and I think that for a lot of kids, one of the situations that I have a lot of empathy for teachers is that they're in the situation where they're expected to figure out what is complex in terms of the psychology and the neuroscience. And you have to go, well, this is why. And we can't all be experts in everything. And, you know, in the same way that I always say, I am not an educator. Well, yeah, I teach an OT class now, so I can't say that anymore. However, I would always say that's not what I can do, but I can walk in and tell you that that kid is flipping the chairs, most likely not because they're overwhelmed from sensory experience in this particular situation, but probably because there's a lot of emotional trauma at home. And maybe in this circumstance, it's because the sensory environment set them off. And once the nervous system is set off, so like you said, maybe it's too loud, maybe people are too close, maybe the teacher's breath smells like coffee, you know, and they're not. And then I can throw in the word interoception to you, which is a new word, you know, in some circles, but a very important one. If they don't know how their body is feeling and they don't have the words to describe their internal sensations, like, I am disgusted by the way my body feels right now because you're standing too close. And a child who's 5 years old and in a kindergarten classroom might not have the words to say it, so they're going to push you away. And if they're at all impacted in terms of their speech and their cognitive abilities, that's going to be even tougher for them. Does that make sense?
It does. And you brought up a word I want to jump into in a second, which is interoception. But Steve, you know, you are highlighting, and to some degree, Tracy, you were just saying, right? Like, there can be these environments in school that it's too much, right? The overload. I also want to highlight and tell me if this exists. I also think our school systems has an underload, right? Like, we also don't have enough time of sensory experiences. So you have kids also seeking that out because the lack thereof is also dysregulating.
Absolutely. And so what we have is an overload of certain types of sensory input, but an underexposure to movement. And some of the classes that I see do the best have this embedded movement into their day. And they have the chance to use their bodies developmentally. Again, so important to know where they're at developmentally in terms of their sensory needs. As we get older, our sensory systems change and our sensory needs change. And you don't need as much of that vestibular input, that movement. That's why we get sick when we go on roller coasters at 50, but not at 5. You get more sensitive in certain areas, but you need more and more of that when you're younger. And they're simply not getting it. And while people are starting to understand the importance of sensory input, there's still not that nuanced education of, you know, go to your OT and go ask them, if it's available, go to your OT and ask them, what is it I need to be doing? Because, you know, I do have the experience of a lot of non-OTs, you know, really jumping on that sensory bandwagon, which is great. But then you might be setting that child up for failure. You know, yes, they're sensory seeking, but children modulation and regulation issues will seek and seek and seek to the point of that they will dysregulate themselves. And so we have to learn what to watch out for and help guide them to these more regulated and organizing sensory input, which, you know, that proprioceptive or that heavy work, that deep pressure is always a good go-to. The classrooms that I see that are most successful are incorporating these into them already.
It's just so ironic to me of, you know, we have so many dysregulated students right now. Yeah, well, and teachers, but right now we're focusing. Yeah. I mean, right now we're focusing on the kids, but a lot of it is honestly the manifestation of the educational environment around them. So it's like the environment is making them dysregulated and they can't learn, and schools are doing that. Unintentionally, but it's happening.
I think what you said in the keynote really got me. It is a systems issue. And when, you know, if I'm asked, well, what can I do for this kid? Sometimes my head almost feels like it just needs to explode because I can't give you the answer to help this kid because it is a systems issue and it needs to come from administration. And I'm sure administration in my district is tired of me hearing me say, you know, oh, mental health and regulation and this, and put me in there because, you know, it doesn't make the jobs easier to do some of the things that we need to do. But if you're going from the design of the building and the programs, it's not about that new flashy piece of equipment always. It's about being more practical and working smarter and going to your experienced professionals who know this and really listening when they say, this is what we need. And that's not what I see.
I do want to hop into that fancy word you said, interoception. I'm so glad you brought it up. I would love for you just to define it as quickly as you can. And then I will go into why I am so glad it is coming up.
So interoception is that conscious awareness of your internal body.
Perfect.
We should be born with it.
The reason I'm glad it's coming up more in education, or you know, people are hearing about it more, is because one of the things that Grainer and I talk a lot about with teachers is that from a neurodevelopmental perspective, the brain develops and organizes in a sequence. And at the same time, skill acquisition also happens in a sequence. And so it has always been ironic to me for years and years of, what do we do when kids are dysregulated at school? Well, have them tell you why. Have them identify where they feel it in their body. And sometimes I felt like I was slamming my head against the wall because I'm like, that's not sequential. They do not know. So that's why I'm biased, but I'm so glad we're finally talking about it because the kids don't have the capacity to articulate the why and the where.
You're absolutely right. I wrote a goal today for someone going into kindergarten and, you know, they were talking about emotions. And I said, yes, we're going to talk about learning to identify emotions, but I'm going to take the word emotions out and say feelings because they need to know how their body feels and how their emotions feel. So I just stick with the word feelings, brain feelings, body feelings, especially at a young age, but even growing up, well, these cues and these feelings inside of your body, if you can't understand them, you're not going to understand why you're having the emotional reactions you're having necessarily. Because a lot of these emotions we feel come from our internal body sensations.
I can't let another minute go by without asking about the farm. and here's why. So many of things I read about regarding that part of your life were what I think could be the secret sauce of education if we believed it. I'm referring to music, nature, animals, rhythm, breath. And I'm really interested in you telling us that story a little bit and unpacking some of those things that really all teachers could do if they understood.
To just give you perspective, I right now, I work in a preschool, kindergarten, and high school. So I am on both ends of the spectrum. I have worked in every grade level over my time. But when I was in Colorado and did this internship on this farm, and I was just in awe. I would come in and she would have real drums. She had a big harp in the room. She had real instruments, and she would use these instruments kind of like you were saying, in order to build the skills, you need that sequence. And for children that we were seeing in the clinic, a lot of the children had developmental delays. They didn't have language yet. And so what comes first is that rhythm, that sense of rhythm and the way you can feel it. And so she would almost provide a soundtrack. I am walking, and she would sing everything, or she would just drum a beat while they were taking steps, while they were climbing. And she wasn't afraid to go climbing, 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 you know, and give that soundtrack and give the rhythm. When all else fails, I drop into those hippie vibes, and I'm really able to, I think, connect with the kids at that level to say, okay, you don't want me talking to you. These words are meaning nothing to you right now. They're overwhelming. You're talked at all day, especially for children who are not yet speaking, you know, to give them that sense of comfort and to be able to change the rhythm to help with the regulation and change the instrument, to give a voice to what is maybe where their nervous system may sound a little hippie-ish again, but to see where it's vibrating. You can almost see that when someone is not using verbal language and may not yet be using assistive technology to communicate, you can see where they're operating. You can read the facial expression. You can see the body cues. You can see it in the intensity of movements and vocal tones if they are making any noise whatsoever. And so that's what we started with, is a lot of music. And then we also did work on the farm, planting and digging. And Lois Hickman was into chasing chickens and the impact that had on your ocular motor system and your visual motor skills and all of these things that kids are missing. And I do call myself a middle path person. You know, I also understand the importance of accepting and embracing that technology is here. This is the world our kids are going to have to live in. But I just wish we could have it all. I wish we could still be digging in the dirt and then have the time for the technology, because I think we're missing out on so much without having nature and being able to pick up that egg and feel that straw and smell the earth. Now, there's some kids that will hate all of that. But I think the earlier we get exposure to that, you know, as an OT, we're going to say that's going to help generate new neural pathways. It's going to help those sensory systems grow and mature. Right. And it's going to create those pathways of development and have that sequential piece so that we can develop each skill as needed.
As a teacher, I taught outside as often as I could because nature seems to be a natural regulator. Can you speak to why that seems to work and why teachers might explore a little more outdoor movement-based learning?
Right. And I think there's a lot of things at play with that from a sensory perspective, but also from a cognitive and emotional perspective. If you're being asked to do something that developmentally and historically you weren't meant to do as a 3 and 4 year old, such as sit at a table and do a worksheet, that's going to create a level of stress and pressure cognitively. So first and foremost, you get outside and you go back to nature and you do more of these sensory experiences, and you are both meeting the child at where they are developmentally, but also you're lowering the expectation to be doing something that they don't have the skill set to do yet. If you're asking someone to be regulated before they neurologically can regulate, it's going to impact their learning. I would say to any teacher that has the access to outdoors, it is always a wonderful sensory and learning tool from, I would say, this top-down and bottom-up approach is what I try to take. Top-down, it is cognitively better for them. It is emotionally better for them. And from a bottom-up perspective, it's better from a sensory and nervous system perspective to help them generate the pathways that they need to generate as well as to stay regulated.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to me how developmentally disrespectful our schools can become. It's just so hard to see.
And that's a good way to put it, developmentally disrespectful. Self-regulation is important, but I will tell you, I'm tired of hearing about it from people and thinking that is that self-regulation is something that a four-year-old can do. How about we talk about this co-regulation thing first? Some four-year-olds can do it, but to expect everyone to be able to self-regulate at these young ages or with disabilities that impair their ability to regulate, or, you know, attachment issues and trauma and adversities. If you're dealing with that and then expecting someone to have the tools to self-regulate in preschool and kindergarten and even first grade sometimes when they don't yet know how to co-regulate and don't have that capacity, that's an unrealistic and developmentally disrespectful thing to put on a child.
Yeah. And even students that are older than that, I mean, it's been a long time. It was maybe at the beginning of season two or end of season one, we interviewed a doctor by the name of Stuart Ablon, who really actually focuses on kind of these principles of developmentally appropriate expectations. And that came up. Oftentimes the expectations just don't match developmental skills of the students. And we are so hyper-focused on what are the chronological expectations that we lose sight of. That's not at all appropriate.
Absolutely. And as a person who's 50, I have never been without the need for co-regulation. So I want to throw that in there too. If someone expected me to completely self-regulate at my age, good luck. Before sitting down with you guys, what did I do? I called my husband and said, I'm nervous. You got to role play with me because I know I can get my thoughts together, but I'm nervous. And why can't we normalize that for children in the education system if I'm able to advocate and normalize that for myself as an adult?
Yeah. Well, and in all honesty, and I think I'm biased, but I think it's the truth. I think COVID lifted the veil for how much we use that and didn't even recognize that we did. Like, people fell apart for so many reasons, but because that access to co-regulation was taken away for so many.
Absolutely.
In all of that wonderful explanation about the power of wilderness, the power of music, right? The power of movement. One word that you said quite a bit is rhythm. And we have been absolutely privileged and honored on this podcast to have interviewed poets, dancers, musicians. And that's a word that is an absolute connection between all of our episodes.
And I definitely would say any OT who has any training in sensory integration is going to agree. And it's because rhythm is so very critical.
Why?
Well, there's a lot of different theories on that. I would say that, you know, some of that first sensory system to develop being that vibration and that vestibular, that movement in utero, it's so primal, it's so necessary. And it is so regulating. And I think if we look at that from the fluid that we're in and the sound that we're hearing when we're in utero, that we're hearing the rhythm of a heartbeat. It's a steady rhythm. It's soothing to us. We're also floating in fluid. That is a vestibular thing. We're moving around. We have that space, and then we come into the world and we lose that. So that is why. So the shh, why do we say shh? We're telling the baby to stop crying, but we're also providing a soothing rhythm. They don't understand that we're saying be quiet when we say shh, shh, it's okay. But what we're doing is we're giving voice and we're giving rhythm and we're rocking. And that's why it is also very beneficial to the regulation. And that's where it starts. And then music and body and dancing, it all continues that. One of the saddest things that I think happens for our young males especially, but young females as well, is that social awareness of a certain set of a gender that has been socialized to say, I'm not supposed to dance. That's not allowed. I do see the movement away from movement You know, you can do sports, but what if you're not into sports? And what if that's not your thing? You know, you don't get to just dance and be free with your body and be free with rhythm and feel comfortable and good about it in society on the whole. And that's a shame. And I really love when I see all people continuing with dancing and movement for the regulation purposes alone. And even if you have to move into doing martial arts or any other sort of movement that will get that out there, running and exercise and weightlifting, I see it as a lifelong importance.
I want to go back to your beautiful description of the womb. Because I think that's what we're all trying to get back to.
Right.
That's Steve's theory.
I like that theory.
We started in the womb and we're trying to go back. Many teachers will ask, and not just teachers, parents, you know, what if that womb was pretty disrupted? As an OT, can you speak to that tragedy? We want to be hopeful when these children are born and they somehow enter our care and we understand the challenges they have. Is it ever too late?
Essentially, well, it's not too late. There are windows of this neuroplasticity. And I know that this is something that is important to Jessica as well. You know, you have windows of time where neuroplasticity is higher in life, most of your childhood, but definitely as a newborn and definitely under age 5. These are critical windows for growth and development. Not to say that there's no hope if you catch someone later and try to do it, but it is harder. There's less neuroplasticity. And so there's less of this neuronal growth and exchange. You can always do that. I wouldn't have a career as a therapist if you could never create change within the nervous system, but it does get harder. The earlier, the better, of course. However, I'm crossing over from my neuroplasticity component, but also that OT component over to that more psychological component. And there, I believe there is always hope where it comes from that. When I took my son early on to a psychiatrist and treatment, they just gave such a beautiful explanation, kind of a visual. Like if you think about it as making a pathway in a field of grass, if you don't give your child the opportunity or need to go down those pathways of kind of losing it from a mental health perspective, where you're dysregulated and you have no tools and you have no support and co-regulation. Once you walk down that field and you pat down that grass, it is much easier to go down that pathway. So by providing a child with environmental controls, getting to sleep at the same time every night, having consistency, having a healthy diet, keeping regulated and calm and controlled in the environment around the child, that's going to help gate some of that possibility for dysregulation kind of taking hold.
I'm asking a personal question just because I have been saying this for a while. So it's not abnormal when I'm in schools and I'm doing an IEP that someone will actually not qualify for services because the impact is not great enough. And it's hard to see parents kind of devastated because for some, that's some of the only way that they're going to get access.
Yes. Okay.
So I have been known to say before, and I just want you to tell me, am I way off my rocker? If we can just think outside of the box a little bit in regards to this theme of sensory, this theme of rhythm, and this theme of regulation, I go, if you can try to find a community swimming program, if you can try to find a dance class, if you can try to go to a rock climbing wall, I don't know. I just kind of start recommending these things that are pretty bilateral.
You've got it. I mean, I love swimming. I love rock climbing, dancing, martial arts, drums, instruments. And I say drums because it's the easiest one to motor plan. And like you said, you do get that bilateral component. And so sometimes kids don't have the motor planning yet to do a lot of instruments, but they can still benefit from drumming. Anything with the whole body, acting allows for a lot of creativity and movement. You know, singing is also rhythm. Singing is breath and is such strong proprioceptive input into the lungs when you have to breathe and sing. You know, those are all wonderful things in addition to the typical sports, which can be very overwhelming for kids with sensory issues.
There are things that we've talked about, all three of us, that teachers could do or take advantage of every day What are some of those things that are practical that all teachers can do?
I'm going to start with movement, of course. And I have to say the one thing that I do think that came as a benefit from COVID is there's no teachers that don't know what Go Noodle is. I can't say enough about some of the programs out there that exist now that are video-based to help teachers who might not intuitively know how to create these movement activities for kids. You know, yoga is not for everyone, but I do like it. I do like the inclusion of yoga and mindfulness into whole classroom settings. Unfortunately, people are looking at this as a fix-all. But remember, if someone's dysregulated, they're going to have a hard time standing still for yoga. If you can get some stability and even just shoot for standing still, that's still great. I'm really a big fan of stretching in terms of that proprioceptive, that muscle joint tendon input. So even just the old school stretching up and out and to your toes. Yeah, I mean, when I do it, I just feel so good. It's so organizing to the nervous system. So I like wall pushes. I like just pushing your hands together right in front of you and just pushing and then switching around, grasping hands and pulling, you know, chair push-ups. It depends on the grade level and what they can do. I also am a fan of music, obviously. So using music, I love when teachers include things like Tibetan bowls instead of screaming. That's great. I love the way, lack of a better way to put it. Using chimes and bells, I do love that. You know, kids are starting to pick up on, okay, breathing and mindfulness and yoga. And they're starting. And even if they just get a little breadcrumb of it, that's still a good thing because they're starting to bring their awareness to their body and their breath.
If I had a dollar for every time I say to my 3.5-year-old, use your words,
yeah,
I'd be fairly rich. So
we shouldn't. We know.
I win parent of the year.
Yeah. I think we're all there together. And I think for parents and for teachers, that's definitely a strong message is you're going to mess up. You're going to become dysregulated. And rather than blaming the kids, I think it's just so important to look at it for what it is and say, oops, messed that one up. And I'm going to keep trying because we're all human. And, you know, if you model that and apologize to your students, I'm really sorry I yelled at you guys earlier. You know, I think that is the best way to model to them that they're not perfect. They're going to make mistakes and that you can understand with them. And that's the other thing. You know, if you see someone moving around in your class and squirming and can't pay attention, try to figure out what they might need. Try to find a way to allow your children to tell you what's going on within their internal bodies. And if they don't have words, using pictures, using demonstrations.
One thing I just had to say it, all my teaching brothers and sisters, you need that regulation as much as your kids do. Do it and with them.
It's really important. And as a person who did develop a curriculum as part of my capstone, and that is something that I'm passionate about, is it this incorporation of the regulation and the all of it, the top brain, the middle brain, the bottom brain, using it all and using all of our tools from sensory and interoception to our cognitive tools. Because there are some kids that also, and this is really, really, really important. The last thing I have to say that's so important is there are some children whose sensory tools are not going to give you the regulation you need to see. And those are the kids that need the cognitive distraction. And that is the piece that when I was working as a sensory-based clinician, I went, all my sensory tools are not working. This kid is still bouncing off the walls. But if I got the child to tell me a story and they got cognitively engaged, sometimes that would work to regulate their bodies. And I think this going from the top down and bottom up concept is really important.
Well, everything you have said today has been extremely important. And I know we already highlighted it, but we are so grateful that you are joining us on Education Suspended. Grateful that our worlds collided and that you just stopped me and said, hey, you, I'm an OT. I'm like, oh, you should be on our podcast. And here you are. That's what's up. Thank you for doing the good work. It's meant so much for you to share your insight and your wisdom with us. So we really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's definitely been my pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Tracy.